I think they enjoyed it. That's the way a Psalm of Ascent should be sung, I think, with joy. Paul Wilbur from his Shalom Jerusalem album, made back in 1995, live concert in Jerusalem, and just an amazing musical experience back then, up to Jerusalem. It's 12 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday morning, and we're very pleased to have Doug Greenwald with us. Doug of Preserving Bible Times. He's the senior teaching fellow there and the executive director. And Doug, you've been traveling all over the country this last week, and a lot of airport time logged for you last week, huh?
It was, and particularly to get to Minnesota, I had to go through Chicago Midway, so that lengthened my coming and my going. But I was appreciative. You know, there's something about being on Southwest Airlines above 30,000 feet that thoughts just start flowing for me, and that was true. Going out from Baltimore here to Minneapolis via Midway, and I got three pocket cards full of notes on three writing projects that came to me while up there. So, you know, if nothing else happened, it was a fruitful time for me.
Well, good. And yeah, I know that the trip up to Minnesota took a lot longer than expected, and was a haggarding day. But now you're back home, rested up, and we're glad to have you back in our little comfortable niche here Wednesday mornings along the Broken Road. You did really two seminars for us up here. One was on Making Disciples Jesus' Way. That was a kind of a concentrated one-day deal, and that was wonderful. Both David and I were able to take that in. And then the last days of Jesus. And, of course, that was timed to coincide with Passion Week here. It was a wonderful two-day effort. Now, Friday night through Saturday morning, and I just want to recommend this experience to anybody out there involved in a church, and there should be some of you who would whose congregations would just be wowed by Doug Greenwald and getting the context of that week. That week in Jerusalem, 1,988 years ago, give or take a year, was a very powerful time, wasn't it? I mean, much more so than even the term Passion Week would indicate.
Well, it's full of tensions, it's full of contradictions, it's full of a sense of expectancy, it's full of the aristocracy making sure they stamp this thing out. It's just a convergence of so many things all wrapped into the Passover motif that when you put the contextual pieces back together, it's an exciting, it's a breathtaking, it's a challenging, it's a sobering, and at the same time, it's a comforting story. And all of that's going on at the same time. And I think that just makes for a spectacular time to just immerse yourself into it at this moment in time, Passion Week, as we journey from John 11 on through the end of John.
One of the things that caught my attention, and David, maybe you probably appreciated this too, was the geopolitical situation at the time. We all know the stories of cleansing the temple. We think we know the stories, and we've heard the stories over and over and over, but it was some of the different aspects of Passion Week that you brought up that we don't get to hear about at all that were of particular interest. And for example, the political dilemma that Pontius Pilate found himself in, as well as the Sadducees, the difficult position they were in, the chess game that ensued between the Sadducees and Pontius Pilate, and actually all the poor people of Israel were a party to this too, and that's something we don't hear about too much, and that's that difference between the two crowds, the crowd that, one, welcomed Jesus into Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday, and secondly, the group of people, or the crowd, that told Pilate to release Barabbas and to crucify Jesus. Explain the difference between those two crowds.
Well, 90% of the people in the land that's in Galilee and Judea, Samaria, are dirt poor, basically. And when Jesus launches his ministry shortly thereafter and says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," that's in Matthew, and "Blessed are the poor" is in Luke. He has 90% of the country with him, all the poor people. They loved Jesus from the beginning, and they loved him to the end. And because of that, they're the ones shouting Hosanna, tens of thousands of them, maybe even hundreds of thousands, on what we know as Palm Sunday. But when we get to latter part of Passion Week, particularly on Friday, when Pilate is having the interactions with the Jewish aristocracy, that's taking place in Herod's castle, the Herodian castle, palace, if you will. And that has a courtyard in it, and you can see the dimensions of it in the Jerusalem model at the Israel Museum even today. And there are probably 150 to 200 hand-picked cronies of the Sanhedrin in that particular courtyard. And they've been couched to say, give us Barabbas. And they've been couched to say, crucify him when Jesus' name comes up. And one of the limitations that we have with the language at that moment in time is there's not a lot of different words to describe a group of people. The only word is the word that we've been translated, crowd. And so crowd can cover 100,000 people, and crowd can also be a word that's used for 200 people. And that's how people have gotten thrown off the track, I think, with this traditional sermon that I've heard too many times, and traditional devotionals, which I've read too many times, that has the fickle crowd as its underlying motif.
Mm, I've heard the term.
And it says, my goodness, look how fickle the people are. They say Hosanna on Sunday, and 5 days later they're saying, crucify him, crucify him. And it's not the same crowd at all. In fact, the word that's used for crowd means the group of people at hand. And so that's a word that can encompass 200,000 people or 200 people, same word. And that's really thrown us off the track, because the hand-selected group of cronies who've been coached to say, give us Barabbas and crucify Jesus, are being designated as a crowd as well. We think it's the same crowd that's anything but that. And that has led to a whole series of misunderstandings.
You know, this is an excellent example of what comes up with Scripture time and time again. And that is when you perceive a contradiction of some kind, and this would qualify. You're thinking, how can this crowd be that way, and then it could be that way 5 days later? Well, if you run into a contradiction, just plain old philosophy says, re-examine your premises, which means we've assumed this is the same crowd. And if you take that out of the equation, then it no longer becomes a contradiction, and it makes sense.
So and if you just step back far enough to do just a tad bit of critical thinking here, why in the world is the Jerusalem aristocracy trying to do all this stuff rapidly at the break of day behind closed doors? Mm-hmm. Because they don't want the tens of thousands of people who love Jesus to even know what's going on. So, you know, if you just step back 3 feet and look at this, saying it's the same crowd who's gone fickle just sort of evaporates when you realize the secretness that they're trying to do these illegal jurisdictional rulings away from prying eyes and away from any knowledge of the crowd, the hundreds of thousands of people who truly love Jesus.
Another fine point that that jumped out at me, and this is a relatively minor thing, but it solved a problem for me. I've always wondered why it was necessary for Judas to go kiss Jesus to point him out. I mean, these people, supposedly he was there with the temple guard. They would have all known what he looked like. I would, or some of them would have. You know why Judas? But your explanation of the Mount of Olives at night. You got to remember, it's pitch dark out there, but you described all these campfires. Tell us about those campfires.
Well, if you have a couple hundred thousand people show up for Passover, and Jerusalem, you know, within the walls of the first century, might have been able, is a city of 25,000 people, you got to put up 175,000 people in a lot of places. And so the Gethsemane was full of pilgrims. It wasn't just Jesus and the disciples, and they're the only ones there. And that's why Judas was needed to sort out all the options here for people who weren't that familiar with what Jesus looked like and where Jesus tended to go in Gethsemane. And that was the role of Judas, to be the bird dog, so to speak, to get the establishment and their armed guards to the right person to arrest.
And that suggests there was confusion there. Crowd, strangers, not necessarily a huge crowd right where Jesus was, but that there was much more to consider in this, many more pieces to the puzzle than we think about when we just
read scripture. Not a lot of great lighting. Yeah, truly, there was the ambient light from the torches, if you will, mm-hmm. that were there, and perhaps some of the lamps that were burning, but certainly not daylight in terms of ability to quickly distinguish who a certain person was. Mm-hmm. And so without Judas, they would have been looking for a needle in a haystack.
I'm trying to imagine that scene, and it's almost, did Judas have an idea about where they would be? I mean, come and look for us at the third big rock on the left. And, you know, it's number 18, big rock on the left avenue or something. I mean, he was leading the soldiers. He was leading the officials and to where they were. And, you know, I guess I'm wondering with this new understanding, was there some sort of prearranged area where they would be meeting, or did they have a favorite place to go and pray or to go and meditate? I've always thought that the Sanhedrin and everybody else had a real, real good idea of what Jesus looked like. Go ahead.
Well, depending on how you want to do your counting, the disciples and Jesus have already been to two, possibly three Passovers.
Hmm.
And my suspicion is that Jesus took them to a certain place in Gethsemane for prayer or teaching or reflection or whatever. And with two or three data points in his past, probably being roughly the same place in the same area, that gave Judas a pretty good idea where Jesus was going to retreat to again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then that would make sense. All right. Because he's the one that has the inside knowledge about where they are and what he looks like.
He knows the customs and habits of Jesus and the disciple group, the Yeshiva,
And for some reason, though, the soldiers with him don't know who he looks like, even to the point of out of a group of maybe 10 or 15. So Judas still has to kiss him on the cheek to identify him and put the finger on him.
Well, this is kind of a bad taste response here, but to a Roman, all Jews tend to look the same.
Now, who were the people with Judas? Would they have been the temple guard? I mean, this was not a Roman function, arresting Jesus at this point. This was a temple function, wasn't it?
It's not clear to me who were the armed guards, so to speak, in the party. To my understanding, the Sanhedrin had no police force of their own. So my suspicion here is that Pilate deputized a small group of legionnaires to be part of this arresting party.
So you think Pilate was party to the arrest, too?
I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I'm just suspicious, suspicious here.
The guy whose ear was cut off, wasn't he somebody's servant?
The high priest.
Okay.
And I didn't mention that, but if you have a deformity on your body anywhere, you can't be a high priest. And so I think this is what Peter was trying to symbolize, was if he could deform the servant of the high priest, he was indicating that the high priest was not entitled to his position as well.
Now, Doug, there's another area of this whole scenario that you didn't get a chance to talk about during the seminar up here, but I know you've got a lot of information to offer on where the Last Supper was held. Now, in Jerusalem, and you know it far better than I do, there are two or three locations that claim to have the upper room. Where's the real location?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we know the general vicinity. The place that everyone goes to now is from the Crusader period, and you know that obviously couldn't have been it, but at least it's a nice symbolic room, and it's in the general vicinity. Most likely, it was in the Essene quarter of Jerusalem, in an Essene monastery. The Essenes are a celibate group who lived out in the Judean wilderness in Qumran. And there was a quite an earthquake that destroyed that community in 29 BC. And because one of the Essene elders had made a very profitable and favorable prophecy that Herod the Great would have a long and prosperous rule, Herod was very grateful. And after the earthquake in 29 BC, gave them a part of Jerusalem to reestablish their community. And it's been known as the Essene Quarter ever since. And Jesus would have been very familiar with the Essene Quarter because tradition says that John the Baptist was raised by the Essenes. They often adopted orphan boys. Since they were a celibate community, they had to sustain themselves somehow. And John the Baptist being Jesus' cousin. And so with all the pressure and all the where is he squads out there looking for Jesus, it would appear that he retreated to the Essene Quarter to give himself a little breathing room and a little breathing space for the Last Supper. And so one of the reasons we feel that's probably what happened is because in one of the Gospels, Jesus says, look for a man carrying a water jar and follow him and tell him the teacher, the rabbi, has need for the room. Men never carry water jars in that culture unless there are no women in their community. And that would fit the description of the Essene community very, very well. So that's what we think most probable took place. The Last Supper was in the Essene Quarter, which also brings in some other issues. The Essenes are on the solar calendar, and the Jews are on the lunar calendar. Those calendars are different during Passion Week, and that may help explain, you know, some of the so-called missing day that people have pondered about for a long time, trying to explain everything on one calendar. With the different calendars at work, it appears that Jesus was holding the Passover meal on the Essene calendar, and the next day was the Passover lamb on the Jewish calendar.
Hmm. Now, just to identify the Essenes a little more, I understand that they have that they came into being back in the Hasmonean dynasty period, like the 140s, 130s, 140s BC, at the same time as the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were really a third group that was philosophically opposed to what was going on in the temple, weren't they?
Yeah, and they particularly, let's say in the 60s and 50s and 40s BC, got absolutely fed up with the corruption of the temple, particularly under Roman rule when Pompey came in 63 BC. Mm-hmm. And so they've left town. They want nothing to do with this religious establishment. They're going to retreat into the wilderness and basically live a monastic community lifestyle. And they're just going to honor God in everything that they do. It's a very scrupulous community. There's lots of ritual purification protocols that take place. There's a lot of silence. And they devote most of their energy into a room, actually a big building there in the Essene community that you can go see today called the Scriptorium. And there they made copies of the prophetic scrolls. And that's most likely how they generated income. They sold scrolls to synagogues around the country and for a price, and that gave them the money to buy food and that sort of thing to keep their celibate community going.
Which would indicate that perhaps they were the makers of those Dead Sea Scrolls, or at least some of them.
Well, let's just say almost all of them. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's almost a done deal. That's a slam dunk as a conclusion. Mm-hmm. They're in the business of recreating scrolls. That's their micro-enterprise.
Now, they were also in the business of hospitality. They felt very strongly about hospitality. So I'm thinking, what a natural thing for Jesus and his disciples to do is to wind up in the Essene Quarter. Were they not also at the southwestern extremity of Jerusalem, so that as you come in through the southern gates to the city, you find yourselves in, which was called the Essene Gate, wasn't it?
There was, and at least if you believe the Jerusalem model, the main drag in the model that's portrayed there at the Israel Museum, the Essene Monastery sort of butts up against the main road that's heading straight towards Temple Mount. And so it's nice to be at that model. You can sort of envision how Jesus would have left that Essene Quarter Monastery at midnight when the Passover meal is complete. And you could very easily see how he could walk towards Temple Mount, skirt it, cross the Kidron Valley, and go to Gethsemane. It's, the visualization of that model is really helpful.
Hmm. Let's talk about the legal proceeding for just a minute. Now, the court consisted of the group that we call the Sanhedrin. And there was a certain number of judges required. There was a certain protocol they had to follow when they issued a death penalty, including reconvening 24 hours later to confirm their verdict. How does that fit into the timeline of that week?
Well, the Sanhedrin is comprised of three courts of 23, and then they've got a scribe, and then they've got a chief. Any one of the three courts would be sufficient to try Jesus. It didn't have to be the full 69. There's some notions here that they're really skirting protocols and force-fitting would be a good word for it, a desired outcome into a short window of time. I would suggest that the way they've done it is not kosher, if I can be permitted on that play on words.
We'll give you that leeway, yeah.
But it hardly matters. They know what they want to accomplish. Most of the Sadducees are ruthless people. I mean, if push comes to shove, pragmatism succeeds the rule of order here. They're ruthless people, and they're going to get done what they're going to get done. Better one person to die than that we lose our franchise here of running Temple Incorporated, and the Romans take our gig away. And so it's a showdown of the OK Corral, and they really could care less that they hold to the letter of the law as long as they're able to achieve their desired outcome.
Hmm. Did they, in their view, achieve their desired outcome? Were they happy with the result?
For a short time.
I would think so. Remember, an honor, and this is an honor and shame culture. It's a zero-sum game, honor and shame culture. Jesus has called the aristocracy a brood of vipers. He's publicly shamed them. In their eyes, their only way to get their reputation back is to take Jesus down in the zero-sum honor, shame culture. So when he got crucified, there was, I'm sure, a window of time there when they think that they had restored their honor. But more importantly, they kept the franchise going on Temple Incorporated, the biggest cash flow generating machine of antiquity. And it's all about power and money. And so, yes, for a while longer, they were able to keep that game going. And so from their perspective, mission accomplished.
Do you know what happened after the Romans in, 70, 80, 70? They put down the revolt and swept through Judea and took over the area.
They destroyed the temple. Yeah.
Yeah. Did the Sanhedrin, the temple officials, did they continue their activities after that, or that whole activity was wiped out?
It was wiped out. We know very little about what happened to the Sadducees after 70 AD. There obviously is no place for them to convene in their courts around Temple Mount, so the Sanhedrin sort of loses its functionality. Just by frame of reference, there are other Sanhedrins in different parts of the country. We're talking here about the Jerusalem Sanhedrin. And Judaism is pretty much tossed into theological turmoil after 70 AD because the temple was the place you went to get right with God. And so to get right with God means you're righteous. And how in the world can we be righteous if the temple no longer exists? That's an issue that was immediately came to the forefront when the temple was destroyed. It took them about 130 years to work that one through. And when they codified the Mishnah in the written form in 200 AD, they also sort of came up with a new theology and formalized it, that prayers would now take the place of each of the specific incense offering and sacrifices, different kinds of prayers. And also there was an encouragement for philanthropy would be another way that you can improve your righteousness before God. And there's sort of a long tail of that legacy, I think, still at work in Judaism today, as philanthropy has been a big part of that community.
Mm. Think of the Jewish hospitals around the country, mm-hmm. for example, that are still working on contributions and philanthropy. With all the power and the politics of this whole story, this whole Passion Week story, it seems like this could have happened today. I mean, this is a very contemporary kind of story. The same issues are being wrestled with every day in the same places.
Well, let me try and be a rabbi here and ask you a question back to your question. Did you think the human condition has changed?
If anything, I think it's deteriorated, but we have nastier weapons now.
And, well, we're not as smart.
That's another deal.
Yeah, my my experience in the Republican Party has not been unique, and it's and it's been rather short. But I keep looking at Pontius Pilate and as a master manipulator, and he has got some of the local Pauls that I know that he puts them to shame. I see his fingerprints on a lot more stuff than I ever have before, even to the point of manipulating him, manipulating the Sanhedrin into bringing Jesus before him, to the point of, I've always got this washing my hands business back in my hip pocket. I'll pull that out if I need it. Watching Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer and all the rest of these guys. I mean, just the moves are the same. Just they haven't killed anybody yet.
But Doug, Pontius Pilate was on a hot seat too. Explain his predicament and the rest of the story. What became of Pontius Pilate?
Well, there's two parts of that there. The predicament that he's in is that Sejanus appointed him to his procreator position of Judea. Sejanus, just within the last 12 months of Passion Week, has been executed by Tiberius.
He was like Tiberius's right-hand man, wasn't he?
Yeah, Tiberius became an emperor late in life, never really did like the idea of being emperor, left Rome and lived in the Isle of Capri for 12 years in Villa Jovis, his palace up on the bluff there at Capri. And Sejanus was his right-hand man, so to speak, and sort of ran the empire. And Sejanus was perceived as making moves, as putting his people in very key positions, including a move that put one of his people in charge of the Roman Praetorian Guard. And that got back to Tiberius, couched in, we think, a coup d'etat is about to take place. Tiberius not only sacked Sejanus, but executed him. And so Pilate now, who was appointed by Sejanus, and Sejanus was a known anti-Semite, now has a brand new boss, Tiberius, and he's a little bit more uncertain about how much of an anti-Semite Tiberius is. And remember, Israel is the buffer zone between the Roman world and the Parthians being the only people who have ever defeated a Roman legion. The Parthians are feared by Rome, and therefore Judea and Galilee must be kept peaceful and in Roman control at all costs. It's almost a hyper-sensitive issue there. And therefore, Pilate knows he's got to keep the lid on this place because more attention is paid to keeping Israel calm than any other place in the empire because of its buffer zone status. So he's got all this going on. And he has a checkered past already when it comes to Passion Week. I think it's safe to say he's essentially on probation. And one more misstep, one more complaint to Rome, and he may be gone. And so this is the game that he's playing. And he actually does a pretty good job of manipulating the scene, this chess match game that we talked about for Pat's going on in Passion Week. And he finally gets the chief priest and the high priest to say, "We have no king but Caesar." Mm-hmm. A remarkable statement by the head religious authorities of the nation, which simply points out how corrupt, how spiritually vacuous they really are. And so Pilate gets through that week, but a few years later, he's basically out of a job. He's exiled, and if I remember the history here, he spends his remaining days on the Isle of Corsica. Mm-hmm. But don't hold me to that one.
Well, he got into trouble again by massacring Samaritans, wasn't it? And that occasioned his removal.
My memory is that that's one of the previous things that he had done, but mm-hmm. maybe it's post. I'd have to go back and check the record.
I think there were a couple of incidences, and as I read, he was pulled out of his. Actually, he was called the prefect to begin with and a procurator later on. That was a name change that happened in like 31, 32 AD. But when he was removed from office, he was confined to, I mean, his choices, you say he would be removed. Well, that means exile. It could mean death to him. And in his case, they think he committed suicide. So, you know, and there's so many traditions involved in all this. It's hard to pin down the facts for sure. But that's the conclusion of a lot of scholars, is that he did himself in the year 36 AD.
Yeah, he certainly did not have a stellar record of governance. And eventually, one more false step caught up to his probation status, and he was removed.
Hmm. Yeah, Josephus wrote in AD 93, this is on the Wikipedia page, that Pilate was ordered back to Rome after suppressing a Samaritan uprising. And he was replaced by Marcellus. Pilate got back to Rome just after Tiberius was killed. So
that's how power changes hands in the Roman Empire. Somebody's got to die, it seems. So Pilate's situation was dire because not only could he be removed, he could be staring death in the face if he made the wrong move with the Jews during that week. So much at stake, and that's why I say the geopolitics of the whole situation. And the Parthians, as I understand it, occupied Syria, so they weren't that far away.
And what we would call Persia, mm-hmm. parts of Iran and Iraq as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm. So many elements in this. And Doug, you explained it beautifully. It makes just a very powerful whole story for Passion Week. And so many parts of the story we never get from the pulpit. We just don't hear that stuff. And it's so worth the time to look into these on your own. And even so worth the time to have Doug come out to your church and do one of these seminars. And you can... I know you're prone to line up the last days of Jesus with Passion Week, but you could do that story anytime, couldn't you?
I could, but thematically, it certainly seems to fit mm-hmm. during Lent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I hope happens in Protestant churches is they get more of a vision for making Lent an intentional devotional period of time. I think the Catholic Church has been much better at having a Lenten focus than the Protestant Church, which gives a lot more emphasis to Advent, but seems to not mm-hmm. give much focus to Lent.
Mm. And I've got to tell you, I have this appetite, this craving for a much more elaborate ceremonial kind of Easter with the liturgy and all the hoopla that surrounds it in the Catholic Church or in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I think of the Protestant services I've been to over the last years, and they just don't measure up. It's a much grander thing than these churches are able to communicate locally, I think.
Yeah, historically, you know, the Roman Church really focused on the sacraments. And post-Reformation, the Protestant Church focused primarily on the Word. And that's the tension, that's the comparison you have with the Catholic Church, the Roman Church, with its emphasis on the sacraments and worship and awe, and the Protestant Church with its emphasis on the Word. Mm-hmm. That's why some people really like the Anglicans, because you can get both.
I've heard that, and there's a lot of folks that go to the Anglican churches for Christmas and for Easter. There's a post over at internetmonk.com today by Damaris Zahner, who's one of the most wonderful writers they have over at internetmonk.com, and she's talking about, let me just read you a sentence from it here. She's talking about she and her family and how they celebrate Easter, and then she says, "This is a good year. Orthodox Pascha and Catholic Easter are on different days, so I can go to both liturgies. My daughters and I, though not Orthodox, love the marathon of song, prayer, procession, and candlelight that begins on Holy Saturday, continues until the small hours on Sunday. We also love the 3 a.m. communal feast after the liturgy, with its steaming crockpots, bottles of wine, and small children asleep under the tables." That's a wonderful picture.
Reminds me of an old pastor who said there are ditches on both sides of every road, and the key is to stay in the middle.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
And I thought it was just because we were Lutherans.
Well, we get some nice flower displays in our church at Easter. Yeah. Doug, thank you very much. Doug, again, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. It's a place you ought to visit. A great source for, well, resources for your church and your small group studies, Bible studies, PreservingBibleTimes.org. You can link to it from our website anytime very conveniently. Doug, good to have you home safe, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
See you, Doug.
Shalom.
Shalom, shalom.